meek here, the worshipers! Where's all of my praises? I want everybody around the world to put your hands together because all the praise belongs to God. Here we go.
Live from New York City, it's the Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null. Today, Dr. Sharon Goldberg testifies about 5G small cell tower and why it's so dangerous. We have 10 separate discussions with testimony before legislative groups on why this is dangerous. The mainstream media is not covering this at all. We will, and we're advocating that you challenge this being put into your neighborhood. It's dangerous. We'll be hearing about some of the problems with each one of these different programs, but it really gets bad. All right, so we're going to be there to let you know about them. We also today will be taking a look at what is called the tyranny of meritocracy. Meritocracy is when you work hard, when you believe in hard work, when you believe in diligence and discipline. That all is now being challenged. We're even told in a new article, in fact, two new articles, that it's terrible, it's bad, it's tantamount to evil. Is it? Okay. Because once these things start to circulate in the world of emails, and people begin to read them, and they don't know if there's a bias, and they don't know the larger picture, and they don't deconstruct it, then we can go off on the wrong tangents, and we do that repeatedly in the United States. So I intend to deconstruct what I do not believe is legitimate or honest or ethical at all in these presentations. I believe that there is a lot of room for meritocracy, and they've conflated the issue. Not surprisingly, they do this all the time. They've conflated inequality, which is rampant in our society, in which we address constantly, with those who work hard to get out of whatever they consider an inequitable position. Now we're told no one should have to do all this. We should simply be given things. Really? Okay, what should be given, in which systems work, and let's see how well they work. So I'm going to go into this in greater detail. I'm going to be doing this over a period of time because it's just too vast an issue and it's too complicated to try to squeeze it all in a short period of time. But we always begin with the latest on health and healing, and this comes from the National University of Singapore. This was in their Department of Psychology of Medicine and Department of Biochemistry, and they found that eating mushrooms can reduce the risk of cognitive decline. Researchers found seniors who ate more than 300 grams of cooked mushrooms a week were half as likely to have mild cognitive impairment. Now, 300 grams, 28.35 grams to an ounce, you're really not talking about more than about 6 ounces. You're talking about a cup, a single cup of mushrooms per week. That's not a lot. So that's important. And the average serving was 150 grams. So two portions would be equivalent to approximately, well, maybe if you poured the cup onto a plate, a half a plate. Not a big deal, but it's what's in those mushrooms that count. And this was published in the Journal of Alzheimer's Disease, major journal. And this was done also at the Singapore Ministry of Health National Medical Research Council. They took 600 seniors over the age of 60, and this is where they conducted this experiment. So we have probably around, I'm going to say 100 million Americans, adults. That's over 40% of all adults in America who have some form of memory loss, cognition decline that could benefit from this. So it's not a little issue. It's a major issue. In fact, several of my own friends, one in his 50s, one in his 60s, and two more in their 80s, early 80s, 80 and 81, all suffering from dementia. And yet none of these people really had an unhealthy lifestyle compared to the average person. So it's impacting a lot of people. So a cup of mushrooms, there's a lot more you can do, but at least that's one good thing. Also, from the National Research Center in Egypt, they found that a giant leafed fig is usually known as just a pretty ornamental tree or a very useful source of food and wood products. But now a study done in Egypt indicates the leaves of the tree could provide a natural way of protecting the liver from oxidative stress. That's important. So again, it's the giant leaf fig, and that helps people with oxidative stress. Vitamin C helps people with oxidative stress. I'm just trying to look at all the different parts of science that are showing the world around us, the living, vital, organic environment that we've been disconnected to and from, I should say, could be a very important way of helping us, especially with so many people suffering from liver problems. And what it says is that this plant-based compound could help shield the liver from oxidative stress. This was at the National Research Center. So that's coming at you, and I can bet that sometime in the next year we'll probably see in some form of botanical or aqueous or liquid drops that available. Experiences of nature boost children's learning. University of Illinois. Quite simply, spending time in nature boosts children's academic achievement and healthy development. That's the conclusion of this new analysis. They looked at hundreds of studies from the Department of Natural Resources and Environmental Science, University of Illinois, and they published it in the Frontiers in Psychology. So here's what they found. There's strong, compelling evidence that the more time you spend in nature, you can have a rejuvenating effect on your attention, relieve stress, boost self-discipline, increases physical activity and fitness, and all these have been shown to improve our learning. Moreover, nature creates a calmer, quieter, and safer setting for learning and fosters warmer and more cooperative relations among students and affords more creative and more exploratory forms of play. And this takes me back to England on many of the trips. I've made dozens of trips to England, and I love the English countryside. I love their beautiful gardens. And I was visiting a Dr. John Cleave, a Captain Cleave. He was a captain in the Royal Navy. And he was one who discovered that when they're eating canned rationed food, they end up with all forms of digestive problems. But once they got to the islands, in this case Bermuda or the other Caribbean islands, and they would restock on fresh foods, lots of vegetables and fruits, that would be relieved. And he wrote an opinion paper on this called the saccharine condition. So I wanted to interview him. I was interviewing Dr. Dennis Burkitt of Burkitt's Lymphoma Discovery, and it was Burkitt who had been working at more than 67 hospitals in Eastern Africa, and he found that a heart attack or appendicitis, colorectal cancer, was virtually unheard of. And he would make trips around this whole group of hospitals. So he had a lot of opportunity to see, was this only in one area? And he found it was a high fiber diet. But they didn't call it fiber, they called it roughage. And so he wrote papers on the power of the roughage, high roughage diet. But the first person to chair a department of nutrition in the history of academia in Europe was Dr. John Yutkin. And Yutkin, I interviewed in London about the role of fiber and the dangers of sugar. And he showed me, he showed me an article from the British Medical Journal from 1903. And already they were talking about the diseases that came from the overconsumption of sugar. And at that time, the average person living in the United Kingdom consumed 3 to 6 pounds of sugar a year. Now, mind you, we're consuming about 160 pounds average. So we're not even recognizing sugar as a problem today in any major way. And they were recognizing it then at 3 to 6 pounds. And yeah, it was a wonderful conversation. And then he said, but you really should speak with a Dr. Cleave. So I went out to the country. And when I got out there, it was as if it were out of a movie, one of these Emily Dickinson movies. It was just absolutely beautiful, tranquil. It wasn't a big house. It was something you would imagine done out of stone, but it was the gardens. And so Cleave said, I spend my afternoons reading here. He and his wife each had these very comfortable chairs. And when I'm sitting there, I'm noticing all the aromas. And I'm noticing jasmine and lilac and lavender and honeysuckle. All these very powerful aromatic plants. And he had a lot more. And it was just one of the most perfect days I've ever spent in someone's garden. And so I said, how often do you come out? He was, every day. Every day we come here and read. And we like to read to each other, and then we like to question each other about our knowledge of the classics and what are we learning and how can we extrapolate what was written 200, 300, 400,000 years ago to what we're doing today. And he said, it keeps us alive. Even though we are retired for some years, it keeps us vital. And when you do it in nature, nature is bearing silent witness to all of your being and thoughts. And that stuck in my mind. Nature is bearing witness. And when I'm looking around, I just stood up and I just calmly just went 365 degrees. I just observed the countryside, the old walls that were put up there possibly hundreds of years ago that you see all over Ireland, Scotland, and Wales and England. And the flowers. It was just perfection. And I was thinking, wow, why don't we understand in America how we should get back into nature? Now, some people do. Out in Colorado, they have very big into the enthusiasm of riding bikes. And I believe that they have some of the best bike riding paths in America. And they have a lot of really good athletes out there, and they train because it's higher elevation, mile high elevation. But the average American doesn't benefit from this. We don't have enough greening. We don't spend enough time, even if we do have it. So it's just something to remember. You're going to do better. Your children are going to do better if we get them outside, get them into nature, get them appreciating what's in nature. Let them explore it. Let them get their hands dirty. From the College of Pharmacy, South Korean University, this is a follow-up to a study I reported a couple weeks ago. This is in the journal Phytotherapy Research. The Panax ginseng, P-A-N-A-X, has extremely beneficial response. And this cures acne, natural cure for acne. Now, this is the second time I've heard this from two different studies. Now, we know that acne is a chronic inflammatory disease on your skin, and it develops when bacteria abnormally grow in hair follicles. And the results of the study show that red ginseng in extract form was able to have natural antimicrobial activity against the acne and the acne bacteria, and more than any of the drugs that were used. And it was derived from red ginseng. So red ginseng, if you have acne, and it can make a difference. Also, another study from University of Pittsburgh, burning more calories is linked with a greater gray matter of your brain. And you want that because the more gray matter you have, you're less susceptible to Alzheimer's disease. So what does this mean in just lay language? It means if we jog or swim or power walk or even garden and dance, the physical activity older individuals, older over the age of 40, you have a larger gray matter volume in key brain areas is responsible for memory and cognition. So that's according to a study at UCLA and the University of Pittsburgh School of Medicine, published in the peer-reviewed journal of Alzheimer's disease. So keep active. It can help you with mild cognitive impairment, where you have less gray matter. And over time, it gets less and less. But when you exercise and you're burning more calories, it gets more. So there's a lot of scientific studies indicating physical activity can help protect the brain from cognitive decline. So that's why I'm encouraging people to exercise more. And finally, from the University of Bristol, which is in the United Kingdom, published in the Education Research International, mindfulness is found to improve mental health of students. So if our students in America could just exercise their brain more by doing simple 15-minute meditations, mindfulness meditations, that could help them. That's what this showed. So, and they got 57 medical students and gave them mindfulness meditation. And over an 8-week period, it made a big difference. So just something to think about. I'm Gary Knoll. Back in a moment with your calls. Please stay with us.
Try to do. Bad luck fella's got to hold on you.
Hi, Gary. My name is John. I'm a third-time caller. Would you please tell me if tofu is safe to eat? I'm a vegetarian, so I'm always trying to see if I could buy new things to substitute my protein intake. Thank you very much.
The answer is yes. If it is non-genetically engineered organic tofu, organic tofu has many qualities to it. It's been used by billions of people. China has over 1.3 billion, and it's been used for centuries, over 1,000 years. So the answer is yes. And its fermented components, tempeh and miso, are providing the body with a tremendous beneficial probacteria, which helps the biome, the natural gut bacteria. And it provides you with easily digested amino acids. And that's good too. In fact, tempeh, which is just an extension of that fermentation process, using a little different medium, it has more protein in it per serving than a hamburger. So you're getting a lot of quality amino acids and minerals, including calcium and magnesium, in that as well. And it's low calories. And it doesn't have much of a taste. It's rather tasteless. Therefore, by marinating the tofu, cutting it in thin slices, depending upon whether you're getting soft, medium, or firm, and then letting it marinate overnight, and then preparing it as you wish. You know, if you want it cold, for example, you could take a firm tofu, or extra firm, cut it into like 1/2-inch slices, and then put them into a plate or into a dish, and then put in some mustard, and that would be a honey, ideally a honey mustard, and then a sweet relish. Blend the two together and marinate it. Then the next day, you take a slice of avocado on the top and a slice of avocado on the bottom. And now you got yourself a delicious little grazing dish. Okay? We'll take one more call.
Hello, Gary. My name is Robert. I'm calling from Long Island. I've been diagnosed with enlarged prostate, and all the problems that come with that have been happening to me. I'm hoping you can offer some advice on how to get rid of this. It's not a happy situation. Love what you do, Gary. Great work. Been listening for many, many years, and please keep it up. Thanks very much.
Okay, Robert. Understand that what causes the prostate to enlarge more often than not is simply inflammatory conditions as well as excess estrogen. When you're overweight, you're producing excess estrogen. When you're eating meat, you're producing excess estrogen. When you're under stress, this is for men and women, In fact, even more so for women, you're producing excess estrogen. That excess estrogen to testosterone in men and progesterone in women can cause hormonal imbalance, precipitating breast cancer susceptibility and ovarian cancer susceptibility. And in men, that means that this little tiny walnut-sized gland, which is just at the base of the bladder that encircles the urethra, and the urethra, U-R-E-T-H-R-A, that's the very small tube from which you evacuate your urine. Now, the prostate also creates prostatic fluid, which makes up the majority of what a man ejaculates, and that's what nourishes and transports your sperm. In any case, it's all of the things that you've consumed that cause this to become inflamed chronically. If your body's allergic to something, then it becomes an antigen, meaning in you who are allergic to, let's say, a slice of wheat bread. If you have gluten intolerance, then your prostate could be bombarded with inflammatory cytokines. If it's meat that you're eating, the heterocyclic amines. If it's the bun, it's the acrylamides. So between these are very pro-inflammatory. Alcohol is devastating, as is coffee. So what do? You go on a clean, healthy, high juice diet for a month, meaning about 6 12-ounce glasses of juice a day, ideally. Your green juices and grapefruit with lemon or lime and ginger. Start the morning with 1 teaspoon of apple cider vinegar, 1 teaspoon of ginger, and 1 teaspoon of lemon juice diluted into 16 ounces of a juice. It could be any green juice. Ideally, it's celery, cucumber, and green apple. Make sure that you're having a lot of healthy oils. A handful of walnuts, almonds, macadamias each day, any of those would be good. Having an avocado a day, the oils are good. The nutrients that you need for an enlarged prostate or inflamed prostate, because you want to increase cellular oxygenation, would be coenzyme Q10 or ubiquinol, anywhere from 200 to 300 milligrams, and DMG, dimethylglycine, at about 100 milligrams, enhances oxygen utilization. Garlic, now, if you want to roast, lightly roast a large bulb of garlic, elephant garlic, and then put some cayenne on it and some olive oil, that would be terrific because it enhances immune function, helps to break down testosterone, which has been shown when you have elevated testosterone, you are shown to have a more pronounced cancer growth. If you have less of it, then you're going to slow it down. Proteolytic enzymes are important. Selenium, 200 micrograms, that's good. And also vitamin A, vitamin E, 100 milligrams of B-complex. Vitamin C, generally, with enlarged prostate, I'm going to suggest anywhere from 5,000 to 10,000 milligrams in diluted form, meaning you're taking it in a protein shake so you don't get hydrochloric acid causing an acidic reaction. Vitamin D is important, generally 5,000. But then you want the superstars, and the superstars for the prostate would be maitake, M-A-I-T-A-K-E. I'm going to say 6,000 milligrams a day. That inhibits the growth and spread of tumors, and it boosts your immune system. Probiotics, 50 billion a day, and then all of the berries you can eat are really good against cancer of any kind, including this. And then to protect yourself, you want the sulfur-containing amino acids, cysteine, methionine, glutathione, and lots of onion as well. Now, L-carnitine is good because it protects against free radicals. And those, then you've got a couple extra superstars. And saw palmetto, Africanum pygium, genistein, those three are absolute superstars. Also, taurine, T-A-U-R-I-N-E, that's an amino acid that functions as a foundation for tissue and organ repair. And zinc, very important to have zinc to protect your prostate. Black radish, dandelion, and milk thistle, and red clover, all are good for your liver and blood. Buchu, B-U-C-H-U, and Echinacea, Paudiarco, P-A-U-D-A-R-C-O. And those are all good. I would even add Suma, S-U-M-A, as anti-cancer properties. And Damiana is good to balance your hormones, glandular function. And gravel root and oat straw would be good as well, and modified citrus pectin. So if you follow that and eat lots of watermelon or drink watermelon juice, tomato and tomato juices, I think you'll do yourself well. That's all the time we have today for that, but I'll take more calls tomorrow. And we have a voicemail line, but what I'm told is that we have the same people calling 5 and 10 times, and I'm only going to be taking one call from each person because we have so many. Right now we have about 500, what I'm told, 500 calls waiting to be answered. So it's just fair to call once. Think of the one question that you'd like to have answered. I'm happy to try to answer it for you, but only call once, okay? Because a lot of other people are trying to get through. Our number to call to leave your question, 862-800-6805. If you miss a show, download us, 701-719-9976, 701-719-9976. Now we're going to go directly into a segment. It's a long segment. I'm only going to play about maximum 10 minutes. Dr. Sharon Goldberg testifying about the 5G small cell tower and why we should not be allowing it.
Please come forward. We look forward to your testimony in opposition to the legislation. You have 5 minutes, ma'am. Please proceed.
And committee members, thank you very much for the opportunity to speak. I'm Sharon Goldberg. I'm an internal medicine physician. I've practiced medicine for 21 years, and my background is mostly academic, internal medicine, hospital-based, clinical research, and medical education. I am going to skip many of the things I wanted to say because I didn't realize it was only 5 minutes. Wireless radiation has biological effects, period. This is no longer a subject for debate when you look at PubMed and the peer-reviewed literature. These effects are seen in all life forms, plants, animals, insects, microbes. In humans, we have clear evidence of cancer now. There is no question. We have evidence of DNA damage, cardiomyopathy, which is the precursor of congestive heart failure, neuropsychiatric effects. So 5G is not a conversation about whether or not these biological effects exist. They clearly do. 5G is a conversation about unsustainable healthcare expenditures. Why do I say this? We've been sitting on the evidence for EMR and chronic disease for decades. And now we are seeing all these epidemics appearing. So diabetes is the first epidemic. I think most of you know the statistics. They're very scary. 1 in 3 American children will become diabetic in their lifetime, and if they're Hispanic females, the number is 1 in 2. Okay. So what does this have to do with wireless radiation? Wireless radiation and other electromagnetic fields, such as magnetic fields and dirty electricity, have been clearly associated with elevated blood sugar and diabetes. That is what the peer-reviewed literature says. It is not opinion. The closer you live to a cell tower, the higher your blood glucose. That is based on hemoglobin A1C measurements. So the idea with small cells of putting the cells closer to people's homes and bedrooms, scientifically, is very dangerous. And from an economic perspective, it's dangerous. And you may not know this. I was shocked to find this out. But the way you create a model of diabetes in rats in the lab is by exposing them to 2.4 gigahertz. And this is not for long-term exposure. So, I don't have time to talk about the costs, but the huge problem with diabetes really is chronic kidney disease. End-stage renal disease, the worst complication of diabetes, leads to hemodialysis. Hemodialysis is an automatic qualification for Medicare. And if you don't qualify for Medicare, we still have to dialyze the patient. And the state ends up paying in many different instances. So renal failure is 1% of Medicare, but it takes up 7% of all Medicare expenditures. I don't have time to talk about this anymore, but Once again, we have, so the other epidemics that clearly link from the science with electromagnetic radiation are related to mental health. And this is straight from PubMed. This isn't my opinion. This is science.
Okay? Medical, for those of us who aren't physicians, what is PubMed?
I'm sorry. It's just the it's our National Library of Medicine. This is where you would go. This is just the peer-reviewed literature. So we have three epidemics that clearly, they're essentially one epidemic. We have deterioration of mental health in the United States. And if you look really at the science, what does it show? And these epidemics are our suicide epidemic, epidemics in violent, so shootings, and the opioid epidemic. And I don't have, 5 minutes is not the time to talk about this. This is in the peer-reviewed literature. I have a file to submit for the record. But these are facts. These aren't, and these are things that have just been glossed over by the wireless industry. And I really don't have time to talk about them in 5 minutes. I wish I did. But we need to examine our epidemics in the context of our EMF exposures. What does that mean? That means that the CDC tracking these epidemics needs to, we need to start measuring how much radiation are people being exposed to. And before we roll out 5G, and this means there are four kinds of electromagnetic fields that we know are harmful to human health. So radio frequency radiation, magnetic fields, dirty electricity, and electric fields. Okay, our exposure, any given person, and all humans are affected by EMFs. Our given exposure has nothing to do with the research that my colleagues are going to cite with the National Toxicology Program. That is an assessment of the risk of one cell phone in the near field, okay? What is our exposure in a day? It's not one cell phone. It's cell phones, it's multiple wireless networks, it's smart meters, it's cell towers. It's this sandwich, and it all adds up. And this is a serious problem for occupational health, public safety, and personal safety. And I feel that it's irresponsible to be even talking about the Internet of Things and rolling out a new untested technology when we're not even measuring what are our current exposures from the current networks.
Doctor, appreciate your testimony. Would you again provide us with your credentials? You said at the beginning.
Yes. I'm an MD. I'm board certified in internal medicine. I've been assistant professor at different medical schools, mostly in New York, most recently the University of Miami. And I got interested in electromagnetic fields after my administrator at the University of Miami gave me a new iPhone. I used it for 20 minutes on speaker, and my finger was burning at the end of the call. So that was years ago. I started reading about the science and connecting with other scientists. And really, my expertise, I've taken care of a lot of patients with chronic disease. So when I talk about diabetes and, for instance, heart failure, that, you know, the National Toxicology Program shows clear evidence of cardiomyopathy in that study. In other words, that's a precursor to congestive heart failure. And I want to just read one thing, if you'll allow me. This is from the United States Renal Data System, Healthcare Expenditures for Persons with Chronic Kidney Disease. So over half of the 2015 Medicare spending for beneficiaries age 65 and older was for those who had diagnoses of CKD, diabetes mellitus, or heart failure. All three of these conditions, when you look as an independent scientist, not someone who's funded by wireless, all of those three conditions are linked. So diabetes and heart failure are linked with EMF exposures. It's very clear.
Doctor, what are your trained medical professional?
Yes.
We don't have one on the panel. What are we to make of the American?
Now, that was just part one. I will be playing, that was 5 minutes. I'll play another 5 minutes on an upcoming show. As you just heard, heart disease and diabetes and kidney failure all link with electromagnetic pulses. These are the cell phones we're using. But now with the 5G, that's multiple times more powerful. So we're going to end up with lots of diseases. And already we're a nation that is this sick. But the wireless industry has spent money all over the place, and they'll probably get away with it for a period of time, just like asbestos and cigarette smoking and so many other things. And 5 or 10 years from now, when we have a completely devastated society as far as our health, then someone will say, well, gee whiz, you know, what about this? And then we'll all wake up, and that's unfortunate. I'm just telling this audience, protest it wherever it's possible. Before we go to our comment of the day, which is about meritocracy, we have Lou Anne Panessi on the line. Hi, Lou Anne.
Hi, Gary.
Hi.
Yeah,
Lou Anne does not know what I'm going to talk to her about, but I wanted to get her on the phone because I just received a message that one of my friends' mother passed, but she said something very nice in informing of this passing, and that her mother was going to die years ago, but she put her on a program, a holistic protocol I'd given her, and as a result, her mother lived much longer, and she was much healthier, and she had many quality years that she wouldn't have otherwise had. So she, quote, to help my mom all these years with her health and not become a victim of the medical industry, thank you, she had extra years to her life. Her mother was in her late 80s. That's the way people should pass, not through suffering, not through debilitation, not through losing their body or their mind. And it brings to mind something that you're doing, and I thought people should know this. So I'm going to put you on the spot. It was 4 years ago that we decided to see if we could do a retreat for 1 month. And during that 1 month, we would have people who all had diagnosed Alzheimer's at advanced stages to see what lifestyle modifications we could implement that could help those people improve, slow down their dementia and Alzheimer's. Two of the people had remarkable improvements, and to this day continue to get better. One is 95 years of age, 94, 95. And he had that Alzheimer's stupor look, you know, head down, no eye contact, couldn't answer a question. And yet after a month, he was vital, laughing, answering questions, walking straight up, and had a sense of humor back. And his wife commented that she was so happy to have her husband back after 57 years together. But another person decided after they got there that this is not a program that they personally had the discipline to be a part of. It wasn't her mother, and they left in 3 hours. You remember that person?
I do.
That person has a tendency to leave everything before they benefit from it, and then you have to ask, what is the real motive? And what I'm finding is that today there are millions of Americans whose lives have been disrupted because their parents are suffering from some form of neurological or mental or brain conditions, Alzheimer's, dementia, Parkinson's, multiple sclerosis, and they feel helpless. And helplessness can be, and has many people, been a conditioned response, meaning they grew up looking at everything as if they were helpless. So no matter what happened, well, that was just a part of being helpless. So anytime there was a problem, then they took on this attitude. And this attitude was actually explained by Carol Dweck in numerous studies that explained to us how we can have fixed mindsets that when we're faced with any problem, we immediately fall back to a learned helplessness. She coined the phrase back at Yale University in the 1960s of learned helplessness. Now, we know that animals, I rescue animals, so I know what happens when you have a rescued animal and it's been abused. It frequently adapts to the abuse, as if, okay, there's nothing I can do. I'm the animal. You're going to abuse me. And then they just don't do anything. Versus the learned helplessness, there's the opposite. And the opposite is that you're not looking at something as learned helplessness, and hence hopelessness, and hence apathy, depression, anxiety. The whole mind and the whole body go down at the same time, and students can do the same thing. Faced with a problem, that you know, faced with an obstacle, they go into this mindset of helplessness. Versus the other side of that, and that is people who believe that everything that happens to them, they have an opportunity to exceed it, meaning they're strengthened by the challenge, and therefore they're going to fix it. They're going to allow what is known as a growth mindset. That's not my term. That's Dweck's term. So now we see that it's the parents who frequently wake up one day, and because of their lifestyle, they weren't willing to change, their diet or exercise or anything else. Now they're paying the price of that. And everybody kind of remains passive. What do we do? What do we do? And hence that helplessness. But then there's also the individual who does not accept helplessness, does not accept the negative, and looks for everything as a possibility for perseverance, determination, the one who is going to strive and learn and grow. Now, I say that because of those people who we've tried to help who had brain aging, premature brain aging, and I have three friends right now who have it, and none of those three friends will engage in any real program, and that's unfortunate, but that's that mindset, that fatalistic mindset. What am I going to do? Well, I don't want to give up this, or I can't give up. Well, my doctor says, yeah, right, and these are people who are smart enough than that. But you had a mother who was going downhill fast, and you asked my advice, and instead of putting her in a home, you took her with you. Tell us what the mother, your mother's state was then, and what the likely outcome would have been if anyone else who had a helpless mindset, if that had been their parent, and where your mother is today, 4 to 5 years later.
Okay. Well, I had been actually at a retreat here in Texas at the time that I got a phone call that, you know, I called my mother to check on her every day, and she didn't answer the phone. So I had been in a situation where I had lived nearby, about 5 minutes away from her on Long Island at the time, and I would check in on her every week. I cooked for her for 2 or 3 days worth, so I knew she was going to have healthy food. But I really wasn't paying that close attention to her hygiene, to what she was eating when I wasn't there and things like that. And it turned out that she had developed a huge MRSA. That's a methicillin-resistant Staph aureus. It's a very dangerous bacteria that's resistant to antibiotics. She grew this abscess on the back of her head, probably from lack of hygiene, and it started boring into her brain, and that combined with her diet, which it turns out she was eating fast food because she was driving still, and she developed a severe delirium that was tipping into dementia. So I had to come back up to New York right away, and the journey from that point on, I realized my role was going to change significantly. Instead of being a supportive daughter, I was going to become her caregiver, because essentially she had no facial recognition. She didn't recognize my brother or any of her grandchildren. She recognized my face, but she had no other facial recognition. She was in the hospital. She didn't know anything about what day it was, what time it was, what was going on. She was essentially mentally confused on every level. So they gave her the IV antibiotics, sent her home, and from that point on, I decided that, you know, I was a power of attorney already, so I had to go in and take over. So essentially, I sold her house, I packed up all my stuff, and I moved to Texas. And, you know, it happened in the space of 3 weeks, Gary, because once I made the decision, all my energy went into that. And I was lucky to have the support of my brother to drive her down in her car with her dog, and so I kept things as familiar as possible with her. And when we got to Texas and we got all settled in, she was immediately on a plant-based diet. We got rid of all the fast food, the meat, the dairy, the sugar, the wheat. the caffeine, everything was caffeine-free. And then I started bringing her for intravenous chelation. I found a holistic physician nearby. And she became, each day, she got clearer and clearer and clearer with her mentation. Her facial recognition came back. She started remembering things again. Her short-term memory, she's 90 years old now. And we've been down here for 2.5 years. And she's doing very, very well. And we've had conversations about things. And she said, look, you know, I'm not afraid of dying. I just don't want to die in pain, and I don't want to be an inconvenience to you. And so she's having much healthier mental processes. She says, I just want to die in my sleep. And she does sleep a lot. She says, look, I'm 90. 90-year-olds sleep a lot. Let me sleep. So she naps throughout the day. But she can still take. She's independent, Gary. She takes care of her hygiene. She takes care of, you know, she has a commode at the bedside. She empties it every day. You know, she dresses herself. She's doing everything that she could possibly do for herself. So I have to tell you, it was an amazing journey. Now, I could have put her in a nursing home or assisted living, and she would have died by now, for sure, because she doesn't really know how to manage her blood sugar. And with your protocol behind me, I know that I can. And now her one kidney had completely failed from her diabetes. Her second kidney was clogging up. We had to put a stent in before she came down. And now getting her IV chelation on a healthy diet and taking supplements and green juices every day, she's doing terrific. Her kidney filtration is up to 75%, which is the highest it's been in 15 years. And she is, whatever her last days are going to be, I feel like they are going to be optimal. And this year, last Christmas, instead of giving me a Christmas card, she gave me a thank you card that said, thank you for taking care of me and loving me. Boy, that speaks volumes. I never imagined I would get something like that from her. But that's kind of all you need to know when you're putting out that kind of time and energy to take care of someone. So she's doing the best that she can, given her current situation.
Well, I just got you on the phone spontaneously because of this other friend who you also know, whose mother just mm-hmm. passed. But at least she did not pass in pain. She had years beyond her death sentence. And I just want people to know what is possible. Now, their doctor may not know this and probably doesn't. And it's not written up in the medical literature. And there's no scientific studies to validate any of this. But this is the real world. And remember, our human experiences precede scientific validation. And I think we have to appreciate that. If we make everything purely scientific, then we negate what happens at the individual level before science acknowledges it. So good to hear that good things are happening. I just wanted to have other people in the audience, who I'm sure there are many people who have seniors in their family or friends, that they're fearful of what's happening to them or feel helpless. And we've got to get out of that conditioned negative mindset. And you did so, and look at the results because of it. Thank you, Luann.
Okay.
Now let's go over and say hello to Richard Gale. Hi, Richard.
Hi, Gary. Can you hear me all right?
Yes, I can. Richard, I just wanted to share a few thoughts with you on the subject of what I was talking about yesterday, and I'm going to continue this conversation, and that is that I believe that throughout history it is meritocracy in its best form, and what supports it that has allowed us to evolve. All of our great achievements came not by chance or luck, but because someone was determined. Now, what a person does when they've had a success, where they've achieved something, that's a different conversation. But the main question is whether our culture today honors meritocracy but whether it is no longer the social apparatus or infrastructure for meritocracy to exist any longer as a natural cultural ethic. You and I and many of the people in this audience grew up with certain ethics, and one of them was a work ethic. One of them was honesty and community service and moral judgment and friendship and respect for elders. But also, nothing was going to be given to us. We had to show that we could work for it. And yet, all of us came from different backgrounds. You and I came from, you know, different backgrounds. And I've had to work my whole life. And so I have a special appreciation for people who come from non-privileged backgrounds. We have a lot of nepotism and favoritism and preferential treatment and discrimination are given to individuals based upon other considerations of their personal merit. This is an institutional crisis because caring, real caring about each other, is completely absent today. Corporations don't care about you, yet they're considered equal under the eyes of the law to people. Meritocracy should be encouraging personal relationships rather than cold impersonal relationships that entitlement encourages. Much depends upon what a society defines as living a perfect soul and a successful life. What is it that makes us happy? Is it through work and effort, or that brings us this meaning? Is it having quality time to leisure, pursue other interests, time spent with family and community? Is it based upon satisfaction felt by giving back to others in society that has given us some blessing for our acceptance? And yet, as a country, we're ranked way down, 36, almost the bottom, along with Great Britain in happiness. You look at countries that are the value work and merit in Japan and mainland China and South Korea and the middle class Indians, mostly the Hindus and Sikhs and Germans and Scandinavian countries, Norway, Finland, Denmark, and less so for Sweden. And what is it? It's the Protestant work ethic. It's not socialism. It's the Protestant work ethic that remains strong, although these countries are not particularly religious. And, of course, much of the Jewish culture is based upon a work ethic. Look at Bhutan and Tibet and Ethiopia and Bali, Thailand and Bolivia and Peru and Ecuador and rural village societies in less developed regions and countries, many indigenous cultures. These are places that believe in positive contributions to the well-being and sustainability of the society, not just looking what they can get, but rather what they can give. And so I believe that we have misunderstood this. And right now, by the way, our colleges have gotten so bad and are so engrossed in this identity politics and entitlement that if you're a hardworking and studying student from South Korea or India, you're now prejudiced when you go to an American university, including Berkeley, where students who, through merit, not cheating, not having rich Hollywood or, you know, billionaire fathers and mothers who can spend $6.2 million that one was indicted yesterday for spending to get their kid into a special university. These kids came from, you know, middle class and poor backgrounds, and they worked hard. Now they got a place in that. And it diminishes the standing of other people in an institution who got there legitimately, based upon their merit, rather than the privilege of getting in based upon who bought their way in or who got in through some other way instead of what was should have been a legitimate way. Your thoughts, please.
Well, I think there's a long historical evolution that has probably brought our country to the place that it's at right now. And if we just look around us, what do we buy? Who are the people that we put our greatest inspiration into? You know, it's kind of funny when you look at Jay Leno and others, and they go on the street and they ask people just very basic, simple questions of history, or even just, do you know the name of the vice president? And they can't narrow the three divisions of the government. They can't even answer these questions. So, we've evolved to the point where I believe, unlike more traditional cultures, which you know, are more on the edge of surviving. I mean, the one thing, when you look at a developing country, or indigenous society, everybody has to play a role in the survival of that country or in that community and that society. And I think over the just with our sense of exceptionalism and prosperity and thinking there is always this growth, the American dream, nobody has to think about their own survival. So we can indulge ourselves in a lot of nonsense. And yes, there's the hard work that has to go, but we're not many people, except for money, they're not really feeling rewarded by the work that they do. And that's one reason why our happiness is so low. So when you mention these other countries like Japan, China, South Korea, they have very, very strong, well, there's the family connection too, and the nuclear family in America has been pretty much broken. Divorce rates, people growing up in single family, with single parents, that's all contributed to this as well. So the whole family structure is broken down, and the opportunity for younger generations to actually be part of a healthy family is not there. And when you have both parents that are just busy working and the child has to grow up with a nanny, my nephew and niece, now they knew their au pairs better than they did their parents in some ways. The live-in nannies that they had. So I think there's a lot of different factors that are contributing to this.
Isn't one major factor contributing to how disoriented we are about our meaning of life and the cohesiveness as a society that respects each other as living spiritual beings rather than identity politics and cross-cutting each other off from that essentialness of life because you're not the same race or gender or academic standing or career position? That when we were growing up, our parents from the greatest generation, born or living during the Great Depression, taught us basic ethics. And those are missing today in so many people. The ethic today is succeed and spend, succeed and gloat, succeed and brag, succeed and become a dim-witted narcissist. And instead of the respect and courtesy show of consideration of a person's real worth as a human being, and compassion and kindness towards others, understanding suffering and its causes, and gratitude and appreciation, and integrity, sticking to our morals and principles, and trustworthy and reliability, and standing up for those who are weaker than you, and fighting their fight for them, and seeing others with eyes of equality. Everyone deserves equal rights. In giving opportunity, in cooperating, helping family and friends and larger community, and commitment to excellence, and persistence, and courage, willing to undertake difficult tasks, satisfaction in what is achieved, not as what is perceived, and being productive either for oneself or others, and acquiring knowledge, either in or outside of educational institutions that empower you to be a greater critical thinker. These are the qualities that I believe are missing in so many people today, and therefore, if everything is missing, then they're going to come against meritocracy and saying, well, you see, we need equal playing field, and since all of you are poor and the other group are rich, and the rich are inherently more selfish, and they're not going to change the world because they're too busy, utilizing it for their own personal gains, they're not going to stop their ascendancy on the corporate charts or the careerist ladder. And neither are their children, because the children are learning from the parents. And so the children are not given a grounding in just the basics of human decency and meaning. And so therefore, anything they can get without having to work, and if you expect them to do anything, then you're causing trigger reactions that make them feel uncomfortable. And then you're starting to see the shallowness of the human being, and the world we face does not require shallowness, superficiality, self-absorption, and angst about everything when we're facing real crisis in global warming. And these people will collapse when the financial markets collapse and mommy and daddy can't give them their gold-plated credit card or can't buy their way into an institution ahead of people that really deserve it, because these people don't know the meaning of true merit. And we're not talking about superficial merit. We're talking about true merit. of what we do. And if you want to know what it is to be Van Cliburn or any of the great musicians, great artists, do you think a person just becomes an actor and gets out of luck and gets into a Broadway show? No. You have no idea the thousands of days they spend studying, the thousands of times they've gone to interviews and auditions and not been chosen, and how they have to deal with that. That's not luck. There's a lot of meritocracy when someone succeeds. Some may do the wrong thing once they've succeeded, and many do. That's a separate issue. But at least let us start to acknowledge what allowed so many people to achieve quality lives. And if they blame it all on capitalism, there's two types of capitalism. There's ethical capitalism, which allows socialism, and only ethical capitalism allows socialism. Socialism, as they deem it, democratic socialism, to exist. You can't have one without the other unless you have true socialism. And then you've got what you had where the government owns everything. That's Russia, China, Cuba. And look at the results of that. So right. They better educate them. Again, the young people should educate themselves more before they talk on these issues, because otherwise they're just blathering and they're not connecting the intricacies of society. Final thought.
No, I agree with you, Gary, on that. But this has been something that's, it's been a snowball coming down the mountain for a very long time. And we're just, and fortunately, I think we're just facing climate change, facing economic stresses, future uncertainties. It will necessarily mean that some of these kinds of structures that have allowed and enabled entitlement to go on for so long will start to crack. I do believe that. Because eventually it's the ethics, this kind of faux ethics that our capitalist, predatory capitalist system has put up can only last so long and stand on their own before it starts to crumble. So that's, I think there's hope that the crisis ahead will bring that about.
On our next discussion, we will talk about the differences in capitalism. There are multiple differences, just like there are multiple economies. There's not one economy. There's not one capitalism. And there's not one socialism, and we'll go into greater depth on these. I'm Gary Nall. Thank you all for listening, and have a nice day.
So I'd like to know when you got the notion. Said I'd like to know when you got the notion. To rock the boat.
Don't rock the boat, baby.
Rock the boat.
Don't tip the boat.